Right. Today is October 4th, 2021. This is an oral history interview with Frank Faulkner, and we are conducting this interview virtually over the phone. We have two interviewers and one narrator. I am Patience Stewart. I'm a historian, and I am calling from Portland, Oregon. Kevin, we'll go to you next.
This is Kevin Taylor. I am a nuclear engineer and health physicist calling from Greenville, South Carolina.
And then, Frank, if you want to introduce yourself and let us know where you're calling from.
Sure. My name is Frank Faulkner, and I'm calling from, interviewing from Hapeville, Georgia, which is a suburb of Atlanta.
Fantastic. Thank you. And then as we record the interview on the website, what would you like, how would you like your name represented?
Frank Faulkner. That's my name of choice. My full legal name is Charles Franklin Faulkner, but almost no one that I use Charles. I answer a phone fast for Charles. I figure that it's somebody who doesn't know me. So I then refer and say that Charles isn't here right now. So that's the way I screen my calls from telemarketers.
Sounds like a good approach. Well, we will use your name of choice then for the interview, Frank. And then would you prefer to be called Frank or Mr. Faulkner today?
Prefer what, please?
Frank or Mr. Faulkner?
Mr. Faulkner was my dad. He owned the dog, so I'm
okay.
Frank.
Okay. And then, Frank, what time frame did you work at SM1A?
I was arrived up there in 69 and left in 70. I was up there for a short period of time during the steam generator exchange. And as a matter of fact, forget the exact date now, I think it was May the 14th, that I was selected to go back to Purdue University to complete my electrical engineering degree. So from January of 69 through August of 70, I guess it was. Relatively short period of time.
Do you recall your rank while you were there?
I was a sergeant first class, E7.
Okay. And how did you end up there? Tell us how you made your way to Alaska.
How I made my way to what, please?
To Alaska. How did you end up at SM1A?
I was working at Fort Belvoir at the SM1, I believe it was, at the time, and received orders for Alaska. And proceeded from Fort Belvoir to, I drove all the way to Alaska. It was quite an experience in the winter time. It was, I think I left in late November and got to, must have been early December, and arrived in Alaska after a, 3,000 mile or so road trip with a four boys and a pregnant wife driving up the Alcan Highway in the olden days before it was paved from point in Dawson Creek, Yukon Territory, I believe it was, right up to the Alaska border. It was gravel road all the way. And, but it was in the wintertime, it was nicely plowed, nice smooth road. Problem we had was the road was white, the banks were white, and everything in front of you is white. So depth perception was quite difficult, but it was a nice smooth drive and had no real problems getting up there. And arrived in Alaska, I think it was a week or so before Christmas, that arrived at my sister-in-law's house down in in Anchorage, and we spent Christmas there. And then the first, right after the first of the year, I believe it was the 2nd of January, we drove up from Anchorage, Fort Greeley. And as I remember, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We got to Fort Greeley, already dark. Checked in at the MP gate at Greeley, and the MP there assured me, yep, Sergeant Large, your sponsor, and he's got you all set up for a set of quarters. And it's, he gave directions up to the place, and he said, make sure you plug your car in tonight. It's going to get cold. You know, that was kind of a redundant statement. It was already 20 below zero. I don't know. You know, it's going to get cold, he says, and it's already 20 below. So that was my introduction to Fort Greeley.
And were you prepared to plug your car in?
Oh, yeah. I'd done all the prep work for that. I had the battery blanket or a place heater under the battery and a blanket around the battery, a dipstick heater to plug in to keep the oil warm, and a circulating water heater to keep the engine coolant warmed up so it didn't get too cold, a small little electric heater to try to fend off some of the heat inside the fend off the cold inside there. So I was all prepared for it.
Now patience, I know we're going to get into some more technical things and other personal comments, but before I forget, I wanted to ask Frank how his family felt that upon arrival at 20 degrees below zero. And we had the story from another SM-1A operator whose wife was pregnant while he was there. And he told us a pretty unique story about his wife getting flown to Fairbanks for when it was time to have the baby. And could you tell us a little bit about what your family thought when they arrived and how that new baby came, why you were at Delta Junction?
Well, we were excited about it. My boys were all, we traveled around. We'd been in different places, and in Virginia there with the new program, and they were excited about going to Alaska and seeing some of their family that was up there. My wife's sister was down in Anchorage. They were in the Air Force, and so it wasn't a total surprise of the cold weather or anything else. So the boys were excited. You know, when you're 10 or 11 years old, everything's a new adventure. So yeah, the oldest son was he was born in 61, so he would have been 10, 11 years old, I guess. So when we got up there, and so they were excited about new adventure, and the wife was pregnant, and the practice up there was that I guess about a week before your due date, the women would go to Fairbanks to Bassett Army Hospital, so that there was no sudden jolt of, you know, trying to dash off to the hospital for the baby's delivery that you see on TV all the time. But it was a week or so in advance, so it was a well-planned operation that the ladies went up to the hospital a week ahead of time so that there was no crisis imminent at the baby's birth. And that was pretty much straightforward. Ends up that I had four sons, and the latest addition was a daughter. She was born in Alaska, so she was our Alaska angel.
Hmm. Sounds like
we had kids born in Indiana, Ohio, state of Washington. And trying to remember which one were, and Virginia, and then Alaska. So That kid's born all over.
Sounds like a well-rounded group.
Oh, yeah. Good group. Good bunch. And they're all equally scattered out now. Wisconsin, Texas, New Hampshire, here in Georgia. they're scattered all over.
Well, I'd like to back up a little bit. And so you mentioned that you had been an operator at SM1 at Fort Belvoir. Did you go through the training program there as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I was in class 64-2. That was the first class after the, at the SM1, the first class after the HP mod was put in. And I'm from series here. Familiar with the SM1 during its demolition. The HP mod was the area where you went into containment out of the HP mod. But the plant was all shut down during that period of time. And the classes were then conducted after the plant came back up. So I was in the first class after the plant and SM1 came back online in 64. So I showed up in August of 64. I'm sorry, December of 64. And started class then at the SM1 and went through the training program. And the year's training there, and then the 16-week specialty training for electrical, and I ended up being the electrical supervisor and the maintenance supervisor during one period of the time there, and the shift supervisor at the SM1, and the same sequence of duty assignments as the SM1A, electrical maintenance supervisor. And the shift supervisor there at TSM-1A.
Just for the purpose of the recording, could you define HP for the HP mod?
Yeah, health physics.
Okay.
That was the area for the predominant radiological parts of the HP program were done in the HP mod.
I see.
Anything that involved radioactive materials, it was done in that new modification.
I see. So you had training, and then you were an operator at SM1. Was there additional orientation, or any was the training any different once you arrived at SM1A?
And it was a familiarization. They were, quote, sister plants. There were some differences, but they were minor. The biggest one that you really noticed was the condenser on the turbine. The condenser at the SM1 in Virginia was a huge, big appendage hanging below the turbine, and it took the exhaust steam and condensed it back to liquid, and that was your secondary water. And at the SM1A, the condenser was, first thing I thought of was just a 55-gallon drum. It was so small. That two reasons for that was the SM1 was using Potomac River water as the coolant for the condenser, and the SM1A was well water, which was right at 40 degrees year-round that went into the condenser. And the second reason was a large portion of the steam at SM1A in Alaska was used to post-heating. So we would take the 7th stage extraction that was pulled off of the turbine and sent off to post for post heating. So we used essentially the post as part of our condenser. We didn't need a big condenser like we had at the SM1 in Virginia. And temperature of the coolant going in the condenser was vastly different in the two spots.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the major difference. The reactors were very similar, the pressure vessels and everything like that. You had the same sort of primary loops, the secondary makeup pumps and all of that were in different locations, but it was still the same basic principle. The layout was different, but the design was, or the function was the same in the plants. That was a big difference. The steam was being used for post heating at the SM1A in Alaska, and at the SM1 in Virginia, it was being just recycled all the way. Had a tremendous amount of loss of condensate out from post heating. You could tell where it was. The leaks were out there because the grass was green. Even in the early spring, the grass was green because all the steam being condensed and condensate loss there. We didn't.
Right. Were you aware of any radiological issues that evolved from the post heat or post heating system with the steam?
No, it was all secondary water. And nothing went in the primary. The only there was no physical contact between the primary loop and the secondary, except in the steam generator itself. And then the primary water was on one side of the tubes, and the secondary water was on the other side of the tubes. So that was the only place that you could have had contact. And if you had a leak between the tubes, you could have some contamination. But that was, as far as I know, never an incident or never a problem.
I see.
Great. Thank you.
Frank, could you describe a typical day in your role as both the shift supervisor and also as the electrical maintenance supervisor?
Well, the big difference, of course, one of my tenants is sending me a voicemail message.
Sure.
That's, I don't know if you can hear the noise or music in the background where he's recording a message for me. That's an aside from our interview.
Sure, we can't hear it. It's fine.
Oh, okay, very good. The role was nearly identical in both the SM1 and the SM1A, either the electrical supervisor job or the shift supervisor. Now, when you got to Alaska, the big thing you noticed up there was that you had a number of civilians, and you had two civilians that were former nukes that had retired in Alaska and worked on the plant there, and they were both shift supervisors. And they had gotten so far out of practice because the plant SM1A in Alaska was an operating nuclear power plant that was designed to go online and just supply power, whereas the SM1 was a training plant, and you were constantly practicing recoveries from scrams or problems. At the SM1A, you didn't want problems and you had no practice at recovering. So that was the thing that the two guys that were retired up there, that were civilians who had been former nukes, they had gotten so far out of practice at making recoveries from scrams that they always had to make a startup, basically. There was no bug-in recoveries like you had at the SM1 because you practice all the time of scram recoveries at the SM1 in Virginia, and you didn't have that practice at the SM1A. Now, the drill was the same in both places, but it was just a matter of reaction time and how quickly you could get it back up and go from there. Of course, the the SM-1A was after we had had a steam generator exchange and refueling, that that cooler was much, much faster operating than the one in Virginia was.
Did the plant, did it shut down frequently, or were these also drills?
Oh, the one in Virginia was, that with was, but, we'd have two or three scrams a night, or a shift, just practicing.
Mm-hmm.
But the one in Alaska, it was a power plant steady state operation. Your goal was not to shut down.
Okay, great. Did it still happen every so often, though?
Well, occasionally it would occur, but it was not near the frequency you had. A scram at the SM-1A in Alaska was an event that everybody knew about, and everybody was, it was not a common occurrence as it was in Virginia. So it was kind of that's what delayed, the reason that it was not a rapid recovery there was because, was that it was not a rapid, or not with an everyday occurrence. You might get a scram once every month or so. But and if you did not be on shift when that occurred, you didn't see one for, 3, 4, 5 months occur. The goal was not to shut down, but to keep it going.
So what were some of the daily activities that you would go through as a supervisor?
As a shift supervisor, it was just making sure that the same drill at either plant, that you would come in half an hour before your shift is scheduled to start. You would walk through the plant, check things out, see what was operating, go up the control room, read the logbook, and see what had occurred since the last time you were on the shift. And then you would get briefed by the operator you were replacing, and go over anything that had occurred. You'd review the clearances and caution orders, equipment that was tagged out and out of service. And that was, each operator did that, the equipment operator, the control room operator, and a shift supervisor would go through the exact same drills or routine of walking through the plant, checking what was operating, what was going on, anything new happening, read the logbook, see what there was, and then get briefed by the operator you were replacing. So it was a routine shift change, and that occurred at either the plant in Virginia or the plant in Alaska.
Were there additional tasks tied to your role in electrical maintenance?
I'm sorry, was there what difference in the role?
Were there additional tasks tied to your electrical maintenance role?
No. Between the two plants, it was identical. You just dealt with the problems that were there and made sure that you got the right folks assigned. You had your crew in the department. You issued your, check the work orders out, and you issued those out. There was very little maintenance done on the second and third shift. Predominant maintenance was done on the day shift. And so the maintenance personnel were basically day shift personnel.
I see.
So that was in both plants.
We've heard a lot of experiences from operators about, their day-to-day and their experiences, but I'm not sure if we have recorded just an overall summary of the primary and secondary loops. Would you feel comfortable just explaining on the recording how the reactor worked?
Well, Well, okay. I'll make an attempt. It's been a bunch of years since I laid hands on a nuclear reactor. But I'll try to dig it up from my memory. The primary loop was the water that went from the into the reactor itself, entered the core, passed through the core, and picked up, you see, about 40 degrees, I think, delta T across the reactor. And then they went into the steam generator, gave up the heat in the steam generator out of the primary loop into the secondary loop, and sent the pressurized steam out on the secondary steam loop to the turbine. And there it was condensed back to just water picked up from the hot well on the condenser, and the water was then pumped into the into the loop again. The primary loop was all inside the containment vessel, and the secondary loop would make a penetration into the containment to go into the steam generator, and the secondary, and the steam came out to the turbine, condensed secondary water back in again. So it was a two closed loops. The primary loop was all inside the containment, and the secondary loop was in the containment, back out, in as water, out as steam, and pumped back into the secondary. The two secondary, primary and secondary loops never mixed. So you had no interchange of primary reactor, primary water with the secondary water. Busy day. Got another call here. Did that answer your question? It's a very, very simple explanation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you provided, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but you provided a really great explanation, and I think it's just good that we have it recorded as well. So thanks for doing that. Do you have any memories or stories of events or any interesting instances that happened at SM1A during any of your shifts? Any discoveries or events?
Well, a couple of things stand out. One of the things that after we brought the plant back up after the steam generator exchange, but we cleaned the electrical generator during that period of time. We had taken soldered solvent and washed out all the windings and everything in the generator. And I remember the day we fired it up, it looked like a pillow had exploded out there on the turbine deck from all the dust had been collected inside the dust and lint and things like that inside the generator windings, that when we fired it up, there was no binding to hold it in there. All the oils and things that were there had been washed out, and now the generator, when it started turning, it's like a big pillow fight with all the little fuzzies going there. That was one thing that was neat about it. Let's see. Another neat, interesting I remember was that we had our OIC, a major door. He'd gotten some way gotten contaminated in the plant. And he had to change all his clothes out. And he wasn't in the containment vessel. He was some way or the other, he got contaminated outside of containment, either a primary sample point or something. But anyway, he'd gotten contaminated, and his wife had to bring him a fresh set of clothes, and she was contaminated. She was pregnant at the time, and she was standing outside the fence sewing clothes over over the fence to her husband, who was standing there in his coveralls that he was wearing at his uniform had gotten contaminated. That was a memory that I had there. It was a close-knit group. That was the thing about both plants. The one in Alaska was far more close-knit than the one in Virginia because we were stuck 100 miles from Fairbanks and 300 miles from Anchorage. Not much going on except our relationship with each other in a very small military community that we didn't really get too involved with. Our job was to run the power plant, and we had no real other time. So our assignment group, or our group of family and friends, were all new plants, new power plants. So we'd have our little parties and things, but it was all a very close-knit group that we had up there. And it was, like I say, a very close-knit group.
We have definitely heard that across the board. I think everyone really enjoyed their time there. Could you tell us some of your off-duty experiences? What all did you guys do together?
Could you say that again? You're breaking up.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about what you did off-duty with your colleagues. What sort of things did you do together when you weren't working?
Well, we'd visit with the different families. We'd have get-togethers. I don't know, like BJ, you interviewed him, I believe. His wife was the scoutmaster. So my oldest son, he belonged to her Cub Scout troop. So that was an interesting operation there. And then we would have group parties out at the Rod and Gun Club. We'd have get-togethers of just between, you know, families meeting with families. Doug McCarty, I don't know if you interviewed him or not. He got out of the program after he left Alaska. And, but we'd go up hunting. Or K.O. Rafferty, he was another sergeant first class. We'd go out rabbit hunting after shift, especially afternoon shift, second shift. We get off at midnight. During the summer, it was daylight, so we go off and shoot bunny rabbits, and you know, bring home bunny rabbits or moose hunting season. A couple, three of us would go out at a time and hunt moose. Fishing was great up there. A small town, a very small group of folks, and basically doing the same things you do here, except it was hunting and fishing up there. The ladies would get together during different activities. So
sounds like a great.
Now, Frank, we've spoken to a few folks that were up there that are still in Alaska. Did you have any? Any desire to stay in Alaska or return for permanent residence up there?
Not really. I left Alaska in the summer of 70 and went back to Purdue University for degree completion. And during that period of time I was in school was when the decision was made to shut the plant down. And not keep it going. So I had no real opportunity to go back up there. I worked in engineering division for a while. Then I went to Panama from there to the power plant, fossil fuel plant in Panama. So I never had a real desire. Now, a number of the guys did retire up there. Let's see, Bill Prestridge retired up there. Norm Gehring retired up there. There were two or three others that retired and stayed in Alaska, working for the power plant there. And they were at a point they probably just retired up there and lived a good life in Alaska.
Yeah. Do you remember the conversation or the messaging about SM1A closing? Do you remember how that information was shared or what the reasoning was?
Not. It's 30 years ago now? Mm-hmm. Yeah. My memory is pretty good, except it's so short. You know, on that case, I remember that. I think I was working in the engineering division at that time that it was decided to shut it down. It was just not, well, I guess economically feasible to keep it going because it's going to require some major structural changes on steam line containment, steam line bracing, and a number of other things. It just was not practical or economical, I guess, to continue it. Quite honestly, I'm not real sure that I ever knew exactly what prompted shutting down the plant totally.
I see. Do you remember much about the popular opinion around nuclear power at the time? Or what did your family and friends think about you working at a power plant, a nuclear power plant?
Well, there was no particular, decision. Nobody was adamantly opposed to nuclear power. They weren't things that automatically thought of nuclear power being atomic bombs. And I was doing that, a dangerous job. But it was just there was no particular thought one way or the other about the philosophy of nuclear power. Of course, I was a proponent of nuclear power, and I still think we're going to have to end up going back to it. You want to get rid of all the problems of the carbon pollution in the air. You're going to have to find out some way to make electricity without fossil fuels, and nuclear is the logical choice, in my opinion, anyway. The sun doesn't shine all the time, and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So, after you've got rid of wind and sun, the cleanest one left is nuclear power.
Right. You mentioned that you went down to Panama after your time at SM1A, and then back at Purdue. Were you involved with the Sturgis at all?
No. Matter of fact, the only time I was ever on the Sturgis was just over as a visitor one time. But I was never assigned to the Sturgis and never operated at all, either case, My story with the folks over assigned at the Sturgis, they were on the Atlantic side. And I had the plant over on the Pacific side, and I told them they were always very lucky that they were assigned over on the Atlantic side. And the story was, why is that? And I said, well, you're over on the Atlantic side, and you've got someplace to go. I'm over on the Pacific side, and I'm already there. I didn't have any place to go. So they had a place to go. But that's, little joke about Cologne, Panama being a smaller operation, and I was over on the Pacific side where I had Panama City right there. So,
sure, they were on the quiet side. Could you tell us a little bit more about your career after the nuclear power program?
Well, after I left Panama, offered a choice of four assignments. I could go back to Fort Belvoir. I said, well, I've been there. I was offered the choice of Presidio San Francisco to start the unit up out there. And I said I couldn't afford San Francisco cost of living. And I had a choice of Fort Hood, Texas. And I said, no, I don't need any desert. And the wife and I had been to Atlanta earlier, and she enjoyed Atlanta very much, so that was my choice. So I started the Facility Engineer Support Agency group here in Atlanta, and I had a team over at Fort Benning, one at Fort Knox, one over at Tulsa, post over in Carolina, and the one here in Fort Gillum here in Georgia. And so that was my duty here. We just operated in the support agency for the post engineers, basically, and worked at other parts around the world. From our group here in Atlanta, we had a team that went back to Panama to work down there at the supporting post engineers, surveying, infrared survey of the electrical distribution lines. We sent a team down to Guyana for AID to help them get their diesel generators back up running. And that was a tri-service or tri-nation operation. We had a team from the U.S. working on the diesel generators, and we worked in coordination with the Canadians who were installing a new diesel generator plants, and the British who were working with the Guyanese to keep their steam generator plants up and running. We supported the deployment of some diesel generators to Saudi Arabia and various places around the world like that. Puerto Rico, we worked down there with the post engineers at Fort Buchanan, plus all the post in the southeastern part of the United States. I'm here in Atlanta. Let's see. I was in Panama. I was promoted to Master Sergeant E8 down there at the Power Barge Weber. And then when I got back up to Atlanta here, I was promoted to Sergeant Major up here. And that's about the end of my career. They offered me the Army said I can. Had to leave the program. I said, "Well, what do I want to leave the program for?" They said, "Well, you're a sergeant major now. We need you to go down and be a National Guard advisor to the Louisiana National Guard." And I said, "I think I choose to quit." So I did.
Could you tell us about anything you learned or experienced at SM1A that influenced the rest of your career with the Facility Engineer Support Group?
Well, it was, you were fairly isolated up there, and you had to make a lot of planning to make sure that you had what you needed to keep the plant running. And you had to be, basically, you didn't have the luxury of running off to the hardware store and getting something if you didn't have it on site. And so you were much, much more self-sufficient up there. And I guess that was one of the things that you developed at an isolated point like that. But you were trained to do that because our plants were basically going to be isolated. The Navy had the plant down in Antarctica, and there was no running off to a hardware store from down there for parts. And same thing in Alaska, that you had to have the parts on hand, or you had to improvise or get them shipped out to you. And that was another instance of during the steam generator exchange, we ended up short a lot of steel that needed to go in for supports on different parts that had not been programmed into it. So they had to fly it up to us in the wintertime on a C-130. And that was another drill, 40 below zero, 30, 40 below zero. You're unloading steel off of an airplane, and they kept one engine running, big fan out there blowing sub-zero air across through the aircraft as you were unloading steel and taking it back to the plant. So that was another one of those things you'll remember, how cold that big old fan was making that cold air blow.
Right at you. Yeah. Could you explain what happened? What was the steam generator exchange? Could you just tell us about that event?
I'm not sure what prompted the requirement for it. I'm sure it was a problem of the steam generator itself was failing. I never learned or even had it discussed of why it was being exchanged, but it had to be removed and taken out. Now, this was a fairly large piece of equipment that had to fit through a 6-foot diameter entrance into the containment. So it had to be disassembled and pulled out and taken out through there. And then the new one brought in and installed in the same direction. And even with all the decay heat, the containment vessel was quite warm, thermally warm. And then you had the radiation in there of all the exposed piping that was radioactive. So you had radiation that you had to contend with, which would limit the stay time of personnel, and then just the heat of exhaustion from the sweating, if you would. So, but why it had to be exchanged, pulled out, I don't know, but I'm sure it was quite a reason for it. A failure of the unit itself. Because it was not a small undertaking. But that was, as the story goes, above my pay grade of why that was. I was a sergeant at the time, and that decision was made by the engineers.
Were there any other major operations that took place while you're there? Core replacements, spent fuel shipments, anything like that you recall?
Not that I recall. Waste disposal was something, but that was all handled by the HPs. And as an electrician and an operator, I never got involved in waste disposal or anything like that. And I'm sure the core was... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Frank.
I don't even remember if we had a spent core in the spent fuel pin or not. I know they obviously had to pull the fuel out and ship it out when they decided to shut the plant down. But I wasn't involved in it. I'd already come back to Purdue at that time. That decision was made.
As an electrician, would it surprise you that some of the original switchgear is still in use by the current utility operator on base?
Nope, not at all. Not at all. That was one thing that we prided ourselves in, was maintaining our equipment. And we didn't have any Federal Pacific equipment up there. The only you know, I don't know if you're familiar with that particular brand, but that was not a great brand of equipment to have, switchgear. But I'm not surprised that some of the original switchgear was still there.
Kevin, do you have any more technical questions?
I do not, Patience.
Frank, do you have any other memories that you'd like to share or memorable experiences from Alaska or SM1A?
Well, it was just a novel situation being up there. Essentially, you're isolated. It was much harder on the women than it was on the men. We had to go to work every day and come home, and the women had a much tougher time because during the winter it was, you know, 30, 40 below zero. Couldn't go outside and play with the kids. Our set of quarters backed up to the school, which was probably, you know, maybe 500 yards from the house. But in the wintertime, the kids couldn't walk to school. They had to either ride the school bus or take the army transport, depending on what the temperature was. When they got to, I think it was 20 below zero, that the school buses wouldn't run, but they had to take army transportation, which had better heating for the kids to ride in the military vehicles. But in the summertime, in spring, when the snow was gone, the kids could walk to school, but in the wintertime, you had to take the vehicles. They couldn't walk because of the temperature. Same thing when that was the problem with the women getting basically isolated into the house with the kids. And so it was much tougher on the women because the men would go to work. We had our routine there and go home, and there the wife had been there all day with the kids. And then it was much more difficult for them than it was the men. That's the biggest thing that I think about the problems, social problems, if you would, of the power plant operation up there was the isolation for the women. And that's the reason you'd have your little get-togethers within the group. They were suffering. I guess all the military spouses were suffering the same problem, but we had our own little tight group that we dealt with. So
yes, I can.
Where are those?
I can definitely picture and imagine the cabin fever that must be felt, not only being in an isolated space, but also being stuck inside because of the weather.
Okay. Right. And, you know, the thing of supplies at the commissary, where you got your food, all that stuff was, they would have shortages. And you would get down there and you'd stock up. When you left post during the wintertime, you never left without, if you're going up to Fairbanks, you had all your winter clothes and everything in the car. You had food in the car. And you just had to plan differently for the life up there. And that was one thing that occurred, you know. Every house had their own supply. We had sea rations, military rations, that came part of your house. That you had to keep those there in the event of a problem. Now, I don't know how true it was, but I heard that if both power plants, if the nuke plant and the conventional power plant went down in the wintertime, there was a four-hour window that they had to be back up online, or literally they had to evacuate the post because it was going to get cold and there was no way to keep the places warm. Mm. So that was another thing that you had to make sure of and worried about up there. But it was interesting. Would I do it again? Probably.
Sense of adventure. Yeah. You had mentioned, you had talked about the steam, the condensed steam being partitioned off for post-heating. Was there always enough heat when it was running?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was, we never had to worry about post-heating steam. We always had enough of that. And then the plant right next door, the fossil fuel plant, they were, they had this, you know, the capacity to, when we were down for the steam generator exchange, then they supplied the post-heating steam. That plant was designed to support the heat for the post before the nuclear plant was installed. So we had the cross-connection between the two plants of either one of us could supply post-heating steam with no problem. We had sufficient from the new plant or from the fossil fuel plant to supply sufficient power or sufficient steam for the post-heating.
Thanks for explaining that. Well, I think we're close to wrapping up, but I'm happy to stay on if there are any other stories you'd like to share.
No, not particularly. It's just that I think back there was a lot of good times up there, and then there were some miserable times. But other than that, it was quite an experience. And exact opposite when I went to Panama, there you never had a freezing day. Like I say, when I reported into Fort Greely, it was on January the 2nd or 3rd, and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it was already pitch black and 20 below zero or so. In Panama, it was daylight all the time down there, you know, 12 hours a day, daylight basically. Alaska, the days changed by 6 minutes every day. You had 6 minutes less or 6 minutes more of daylight, depending on is approaching the longest day of the year or the shortest day of the year. And it changed by 6 minutes a day. Conversely, in Panama, it's basically 12 hours one way or the other. 6:15 or so in the morning, it gets daylight. 6:15 in the afternoon, it got dark in Panama. But in Alaska, it was 6 minutes a day changing. Every day was 6 minutes different from the day before. So that was something you had to get used to.
That's quite drastic.
Yep. And in the summertime, there in Alaska, you had to literally put tinfoil or aluminum foil on the windows so that you could get some dark. The kids could go to bed. You know, at midnight, it's still the sun's up and there's daylight. Kids want to go out and play. Well, wait a minute there. You know, it's bedtime. Well, it's daylight. No, it's bedtime. Time to go to bed. So you had to literally darken the rooms. Even the dark room darkening drapes and things weren't sufficient. So we would tape aluminum foil on the windows to summertime to make it dark so the kids could go to bed. Difference in operations.
Sure.
Isolated posts like that, and the swings in temperature and the swings in timing and daylight. You know.
Absolutely. Yep. Kevin, anything else from you?
Nothing on my end.
Okay. Well, Frank, thank you so much for your time today, for doing this interview, and thank you for your service to the Army Nuclear Power Program. and for your time at SM1A.
Well, it's very good. It's been a pleasure on there. I can't think of anything I would have done in the military that would have been more fulfilling than working in the power plants. I don't know if you've talked to any of the other guys, but and the qualifications that we had to have to go into the program were extremely stringent. You had to have on the military aptitude test and everything, you had to have a minimum of 115 on your GT score, which was kind of the rough equivalent of the IQ. You had to have that. That was the highest in anything in the military schooling to get to that. Then you had the intense training that you went through. I don't know if anybody mentioned it to you, but the first thing we did when we went to school and showed up for class, we took had to take the Evelyn Woods speed reading course, because you were going to get bombarded for 8 hours a day with information. And then you had your homework to do at night. And then you go back the next day for essentially 8 hours of lecture again. So it was, information was coming at you hard and fast during the school. And the attrition rate was something like 30% or more at the school, because it was so intense, the instruction. But you had, everybody was there, was used to being number one in their class at anything they went to. And then you got to the new power program, everybody had been number one. So now you got a competition there of folks who were all successful. And then now you're competing with everybody else who had been successful. So it was quite a change from most military schools you went to. The nuclear power program was very intense.
Wow.
And fulfilling, too.
Mm-hmm. What a specialized group.
Oh, yeah, weird, too. That's what the wife says. Y'all are all strange. You're a weird bunch. And we agreed, yes. That's what made us special. Mm-hmm. We were all weird and enjoyed the competition, and we're all, like to think we're all very intelligent and had a good time competing with one another. But anyway, thank you for the opportunity for sharing some memories, dredged up some of hadn't thought about for years.
Well, it's definitely been our pleasure talking with you. So thank you again.
All right.
All right. I'll go ahead and
thank you, Frank.
Conclude the interview now.